Iran says it's high time that the United States made its decision in response to Tehran's initiatives of the revival of the 2015 deal. Russian forces are now in control of half of the eastern Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk. They're pushing deeper into the Donbas region. The Eurozone inflation rises to a new record high as the Russia-Ukraine war keeps pushing prices up. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The top story this hour, Iran saying that the latest reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency on its nuclear activities are unbalanced and unfair. According to the Foreign Ministry spokesman, the reports repeat the same errors that existed in the Director General's briefing to the European Parliament. Said Khatibzadeh says that even the agency has admitted to those flaws already. Khatibzadeh urged the IAEA to avoid politicizing its reports under pressure from Israel and other parties. He also talked about efforts to revive the 2015 Iran deal, adding that everything now hinges on the United States making the right decision.
The United States has unfortunately failed so far to give the required response. If the U.S. stops hesitating in its words and actions and moves toward making a political decision, there will be no impasse in the talks, and the small but outstanding issues in the agreement can be finalized. The current pause in the negotiations is because of U.S. failure to respond to the initiatives put forth by Iran and the European side.
Khatibzadeh added that what Iran needs more than anything now is guarantees that it will economically benefit from any agreement. He said other details, including the U.S. blacklisting of the IRGC, will have to be decided at the negotiating table. U.S. sanctions on Iran are affecting the country's ties with other countries. Now, this time, they've created tensions with Greece after it seized an Iranian oil tanker and handed over its cargo to the U.S. The naval drama came at a critical juncture for the talks on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal.
Greek authorities impounded an Iranian flag tanker carrying oil earlier this month, citing U.S. sanctions on Iran. The United States later confiscated the oil on board. Iran's foreign ministry on Wednesday summoned the Greek chargé d'affaires to protest the seizure of the Iranian flagged vessel and confiscation of crude cargo in the European country's territorial waters. The ministry condemned Greece's unacceptable surrender to illegal U.S. pressures and said the seizure of the cargo of the ship with the flag of the Islamic Republic of Iran was an example of international piracy.
Well, the Greek authorities have acted evidently under instructions from the United States, and probably they don't even have an explanation. They just executed what they were requested, as it always happens with countries that are under the patronage of the United States. So the situation is always the same. The United States decides who should be punished, and there are some executors.
Iran's Ports and Maritime Organization issued a statement also describing the move as an act of piracy that was in violation of international standards. According to the statement, the vessel had faced adverse weather conditions and experienced some technical problems which led it to call for assistance. Under international and technical regulations and standards, the state with the nearest coastline to the vessel calling for assistance due to safety threats, which was in this case Greece, should have cooperated by guiding the vessel to a place of safety where the problems could be resolved before sending it off on its international voyage.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps seized two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf on Friday, citing maritime violations. Although the incident came right on the heels of Greece's confiscation of an Iranian tanker, countries such as France were quick to condemn Iran, whereas they'd remain silent in the face of Greece's naval seizure. What can explain such double standard?
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released a video of the recent seizure of two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. The video shows IRGC's heli-borne special forces boarding the Greek ships ahead of their seizure over violations in the waters of the Persian Gulf. Iran's foreign ministry said one of the vessels, the Delta Poseidon, was sailing international waters at the time, adding that the second tanker was near the Iranian coast when seized. The ministry also said 9 Greeks were among the crews of both vessels, but did not give a number of the other sailors on board. Iran's ports and maritime organization said on Saturday that the crews of the 2 Greek oil tankers are not detained but are aboard the vessels and in good health. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken labeled the seizure as unjustified, calling for the release of the tankers and their crews. France, too, called it, quote, a serious violation of international law, while making no mention of the seized Iranian tanker. The seizure of an Iranian oil tanker comes as talks for the revival of the 2015 deal remain stalled.
Well, evidently they've calculated that exerting what they call the maximum pressure on Iran is the necessary thing to do in order to obtain the maximum during the negotiations. It is something that it's difficult to evaluate, but evidently is not a friendly move. Is an indication of the fact that for them Iran still is under sanctions, and therefore to be excluded from international trade in energy, in the energy sector.
The U.S. administration claims it wants to see the JCPOA restored, but actions speak louder than words.
Veteran Lebanese politician Nabih Berri is re-elected as the Speaker of Lebanon's parliament. This will be his 7th term in office. Berri is the leader of the Amal movement, any supporter of Hezbollah resistance movement. The new parliament started after a vote on May 15th. The election was the first since the devastating blast in Beirut Port in 2020 and economic collapse. The crisis is the gravest threat to Lebanon's stability since the 15-year civil war ended in 1990. We're joined by Beirut's correspondent Mariam Saleh a short time ago, and she explained why the re-election of Nabih Berri as parliament speaker is important in the current atmosphere of the Lebanese politics.
The issue is that when, in light of the rift that you have in the country and the divisions, especially with a group of candidates and some of them, of course, in the parliament now, talking about their focus is to disarm the resistance. With that said, and Speaker Nabih Berri is a close ally to the resistance. He is actually a part and parcel of the resistance, if we may say, bloc in Lebanon. And he got that number of votes and won today as a speaker. I think that that is very significant to look at the layout that those who are anti-resistance do not have the majority. That is on one hand. On the other hand, this is somewhat of a necessary formality to have a speaker in order for there to be work for the parliament, that the parliament can begin to become productive. They need to go into the other challenges. This was the first challenge. And many had said that there will be problems and issues if the speaker is not elected. And as you know, as a result of the sectarian formation in our country, right. And of course, that said, with the fact that the Muslim Shiites are mainly those who are pro-resistance, Speaker Berri was the only candidate. And this is why we had some issues with some of the other groups who said they wanted to elect others, while all the Muslim Shiites wanted only Berri to be in power.
British Government Minister Michael Gove has launched an astonishing attack on the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, claiming that it fuels anti-Semitic hate crimes in the UK. The comment has caused outrage among pro-Palestine groups, but is not a first of its kind, as Downing Street preparing new anti-BDS legislation for later this year.
A British government minister has launched a direct attack on the pro-Palestine boycott campaign against Israel, claiming that the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement fuels anti-Semitism, including hate crimes in Jewish-rich areas of London. Speaking while visiting Orthodox Jewish community leaders in North London, Community Secretary Michael Gove was quoted by a pro-Israel newspaper stating,
"The BDS campaign is not about running an ethical foreign policy. The BDS campaign is designed for only one purpose, to attack and delegitimize the state of Israel and the idea that there should be a Jewish state at all. The campaign has not only undermined efforts for peace in the Middle East, it also leads to community tension in the UK. We have seen an increase in anti-Semitic incidents, and the BDS campaign is a driver of that."
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. Pro-Israel groups have long lobbied British authorities to act against the practice. Those demands appear to have been answered, with plans announced to ban economic and cultural boycotts of Israel, with new anti-BDS legislation announced during the Queen's speech on May the 10th, a move slammed by pro-Palestine activists.
First and foremost, I think Israel is really concerned with its accesses against the Palestinians, and the civil society is rising up against them. This concern obviously means that the supporters of Israel want to make sure that Israel can continue with its occupation, and they want to close down all potential avenues that highlights the Israeli aggression and human rights violation. And therefore, we see the British government, the Conservative government, who's very close to Israel, to stop the British citizens from trying to carry out their democratic right.
Since the Queen's speech, several government ministers have targeted the BDS. Just last week, Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the BDS racist during a talk at a pro-Israel event. According to Mr. Gove, the anti-BDS legislation will be put forward to the House of Commons before the end of this year. The move, described as a chilling attack on democracy, will also potentially face legal challenges, meaning that the fight for Palestine here in the UK is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
Sacked Bristol University professor David Miller is facing pressure again over his pro-Palestine stance. The London-based Community Security Trust, which gives advice to the Jewish community in the UK, has accused Miller of repeating what it calls extremism slur. And that after Miller republished a show aired on Press TV on his Twitter segments, the program, Palestine Declassified, probes Israel's global war against solidarity with the Palestinian people. Miller has denied the allegation. In October 2021, he was sacked by the University of Bristol over comments critical of Israel and Zionism. Okay, from London, let's bring in David Miller, writer, investigative researcher, and professor. Good to have you with us. So tell us, what was it? What kind of comment was that? They didn't like it so much you lost your job at the university.
Well, I did a lecture on Islamophobia, and I said that part of the problem of Islamophobia was that parts of the Zionist movement were actively engaged in promoting anti-Muslim hatred, and they didn't like that. So they investigated me for a year and a half, and then they found me entirely not guilty of any anti-Semitism or indeed any problems at all. But the university was still under pressure after that, and subsequently, I was involved in a meeting where I said that what happened was that I'd been attacked by the Union of Jewish Students and by the Bristol University Jewish Society, and they had complained about me, which of course was true. And the university then investigated me again and found that I was not guilty of anti-Semitism, but that the words I had used, the way I had used the words, in particular the word attacked, was inappropriate. And therefore, that they had to sack me.
So, Professor, tell us more about the pressure that you're facing, especially after doing this show. And also, what about the question of freedom of expression that Western countries have been boasting of? And, you know, and even it's an excuse to attack other countries and do this regime change and all that. So in the UK, you are not able to express what you feel. And it looks like that you've just uttered out the fact.
Well, I said some facts which the Zionist movement didn't like, and they spent 3 years trying to get rid of me, and they succeeded. And now I produced this show called Palestine Declassified, and the Zionist movement have decided they don't like that either, and that they will try and find ways to keep on with the attacks. So just last week, for example, we had an attack on us which said that I had hurled terrible slurs at this particular Jewish sect which is engaged in extremist activity. In fact, according to Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence agency, it's involved in most of the price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But it was said that it was wrong for me to say that these people were extremists because they're very nice people. And so I did a thread on Twitter and said, well, actually, here's some evidence that this is an extremist movement that believes mm-hmm. in Jewish supremacy and believes that, for example, non-Gentiles, non-Jews, that Gentiles have an animal soul, and that indeed even this is permissible to kill Palestinian babies because in the future they might grow up to hate Israel. So I again, I'm trying to bring some facts from my research and the research done for the program to public attention, and the Zionists don't like that very much, and that's because, you know, by and large they're mm-hmm. signed up with an extreme ideology, which is Zionism, which is intrinsically racist.
Okay, no problem, David. Keep up the good work, and thanks for joining us. David Miller, writer, investigative researcher in London. Now, day 97 of the Russia-Ukraine war, Moscow saying it's down the Ukrainian fighter jet over southern Ukraine.
The Su-25 aircraft of the Ukrainian Air Force was downed in the Kobzarsky area of Nikolaev region.
According to the official, Russian forces and their allied fighters also launched multiple drone attacks against Ukrainian military targets in the Donetsk region. Three command posts, dozens of staging areas, one radar station, and two ammunition depots were set to be hit. Meanwhile, fighting is raging in Donbass, a severe Donetsk city that has now turned into the main battlefield. Ukrainian officials say that Russian forces are in control of half of the city. The Eurozone is beginning to feel the pinch of a new record high inflation as the Ukraine-Russia conflict keeps pushing prices up in the 19-member monetary union. Preliminary figures from Europe's Statistics Office show that inflation in the Eurozone area climbed over 8% in May. The figure is up from 7.5% in April. Inflation is at multi-decade highs in several major European economies, including Germany and France. It also remains persistently high in the UK and the US, and this has been driven by soaring energy and food prices stemming from the Russia-Ukraine war. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about the events which led to Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we try to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. This time, you will hear on the events after the Imam's arrest, particularly the historical uprising of June 5th, 1963. Stay with us, please. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest was like a big blast in the country, as the people of Qom, Tehran, and other cities poured to the streets to protest against the Pahlavi regime's move. The demonstrators chanted slogans like "Death to the Shah" and "Either Death or Khomeini." In the holy city of Qom, people swarmed around the Imam's house and chanted anti-regime slogans. The tyrannical regime, in order to intimidate the people, flew military planes over the city, but angry people became more persistent in their move and called for unconditional release of their great leader and source of emulation. The agents of the Shah, scared of the spread of anti-regime sentiments, opened fire and massacred hundreds of people. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest caused people from all walks of life to demonstrate across the city. University students closed their classes and poured to the campuses in protest. Owners of different occupations in bazaar closed their shops and poured to the streets. Students spread their rallies to the streets and joined the people, demanding the Imam's immediate liberation. The regime security and police forces tried to control the city by cannons and tanks. In Tehran, too, hundreds of people were massacred by the bullets of the mercenaries of the Shah. In the evening of June 5, 1963, Tehran was plunged in silence. Trucks were gathering the bodies of martyrs to take them to cemeteries. The whole city was full of soldiers to suppress any protest. The people in the small city of Peshwa near Varamin in southeast of Tehran created a great epic as they heard the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest. These people, most of whom were farmers, started marching over 20 kilometers toward Tehran while they were wearing their shrouds as a sign of preparedness for death. They chanted slogans like, Khomeini, Khomeini, you are the son of Hussein. Either death or Khomeini. And death to the Shah. Moreover, the people of regional villages joined the marchers and shaped great masses in Varamin. Thus, the people of Varamin also joined the demonstration marching toward Tehran. Almost at sunset, they faced the military squads of the tyrannical regime, Bagherabad village. Seeing the stiff resistance of the people, the military forces cruelly massacred thousands of innocent people and injured thousands of others. People in Qom had gathered around the imam's house. The imam's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, relates, the sound of either death or Khomeini and Khomeini, Khomeini, may God guard you, may your bloodthirsty enemy be dead, had filled our home. The sound came from the street, but it seemed to come from behind the door. Our home was the venue of ladies. They would come and faint. I would put their heads in my lap and restore their health with water and juice. They were the wives of the poor seminary students and classes who really loved the imam. Imam Khomeini's wife, referring to the taunting of a few women affiliated to the regime, continues, but at the same time, some women would come and break our hearts with pungent remarks, yet we had decided to keep calm. Comparing the women who would faint with those who would taunt us was the comparison of poverty and courage with richness and compromise. Imam Khomeini's wife points to the horrible atmosphere of Qom and the regime's flying of military planes over the city on June 5th, saying, on June 5th, the regime had ordered phantom planes to fly over Qom to intimidate people. Women and men in Qom had become scared of breaking the sonic wall in the city. It seemed that the planes would fly low when they reached our house. They would maneuver with queer speed over the city, and this would deteriorate the condition of most women in our house. So I and my daughters would give them juice. They had come to soothe us, but it was we who were soothing them. Lady Saghafi continues on the self-sacrifice and resistance of people in those days. People went on a stiff strike and closed all shops for 15 days. At last, the government forced the people to open their jobs and shops through intimidation and burning some shops and demolishing big stores. Of course, upon my elder son, Mustafa's opinion and permission, bakeries and butcheries opened for a few hours in the first days to meet people's needs. Fruits had gone bad in shops, but nobody would open. Honestly, people showed high self-sacrifice and resistance. She continues, near the sunset, there was a rumor of attacking our house at night to captivate women. This rumor made men think over replacing us. Mr. Ishraqi and Mustafa asked for replacement. I told them, are you scared? They said, we have heard so. I said, it is false. I won't leave this house. I am ready for captivity but not escape. I resisted, but Mustafa was anxious and angry, so I accepted unwillingly. We went to Mr. Eshraqi's house. God knows how it was hard for me, but I tolerated. We went and came back the day after to see that I was right.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thank you. A senior Israeli official has traveled to the Saudi capital and met inside the royal palace with a high-ranking Saudi official. According to Israel's Channel 12, the visit was meant to coordinate security cooperation between the two sides, which included the alleged common threats posed by Iran. The visit was linked to the two sides' mutual interest in leveling up their relations. In March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said, "Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy, but looks to it as a potential ally," saying they have many interests that can pursue together. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have no formal diplomatic relations, although it is widely believed that they do have contacts behind the scenes. There are plenty of examples of this. In 2018, it was reported that the chief of staff of the Israeli army met his Saudi counterpart to discuss terrorism and the alleged threat from Iran. Saudi Arabia's decision to allow Air India flights to and from Tel Aviv to transit through Saudi airspace are tangible signs of a shift. When bin Salman was asked about Israel having a say on stolen Palestinian land, he said he believes that the Jewish people have a right to a nation-state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. U.S. President Joe Biden is going to travel to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden administration officials are in talks with the Saudis about arranging a potential in-person meeting between Biden and the Saudi prince for the first time. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's advisor Eyal Hulata is expected to travel to the U.S. next week. Earlier this week, two senior U.S. officials reportedly visited Riyadh as the Biden administration is quietly mediating a Red Sea deal between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt that involves the transfer of two strategic islands, Tiran and Sanafir, in the Red Sea from Egyptian to Saudi sovereignty with Israeli consent. The deal could also pave the way for the official announcement of the normalization of ties between Riyadh and Tel Aviv. When asked about the report, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan refused to deny it, only saying more steps needed to be taken to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2020, Israel's then Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Riyadh and met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This year saw Washington brokering normalization of relations between the Israeli regime and some Arab states, including United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's key Arab allies in the region. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. Israel and Saudi Arabia have for years been conducting covert talks on diplomatic, security, and business affairs, and now Washington is trying to improve ties with Riyadh. U.S. officials are even seeking to organize a meeting between Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince. This comes against the backdrop of the global energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine. Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to rock the global energy market. The U.S. is finding itself increasingly reliant on Saudi Arabia, the world's largest crude oil exporter.
A Zionist entity like Israel, I can't really call them a country because they're not. Palestine is the legitimate country. Israel has usurped and stolen the land. So I would caution any nation. I look at what Israel has done to the United States, how they have infiltrated and use the Jewish population in the U.S. to influence our foreign policy in a manner that is no longer favorable to the American people, but instead is favorable to the government of Israel.
Saudi Arabia has refrained from normalizing ties with Israel, unlike Bahrain and UAE, saying it would not do so without a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But bin Salman calling Tel Aviv a potential ally could indicate that Riyadh has already betrayed the Palestinian cause, and admitting it overtly is only a matter of time.
The
the U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack.
I was just devastated. It's heart-rendering for us as grandparents. We have children in the age vicinity that happened here. It's overwhelming.
In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and six staff were killed.
Why are you here? If not to solve a problem as existential as this. This isn't inevitable. These kids weren't unlucky. This only happens in this country and nowhere else. Nowhere else do little kids go to school thinking that they might be shot that day.
The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York.
So to me, it's really two factors. It's troubled kids, troubled young people, and guns. And every country has troubled young people to some extent, but not every country has a system where you can get guns so easily.
The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people.
The Republican Party, the Democratic Party, can't say anything about it because the colonial mode of production, the violence that's required by the colonial mode of production is what keeps, is the lifeblood for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society.
So, no, there is no irony that the biggest purveyor of colonial violence is also the biggest supplier of guns. That's why they have hundreds of military installations. They, being the United States, has, hundreds of military installations around the world, Army, Air Force, Marines, and the Coast Guard, whatever else they have, and even in within the United States borders, the police department, sheriff department, the marshals, all those instruments of violence exist.
The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations. U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law, by the United States' own agreement, are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no bloc of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack. In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed. The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York. The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people. That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society. The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en.
And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.